proceed with the third case of the morning, United States versus Al-Halabi. Mr. O'Connor.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Timothy O'Connor. Along with John Meyer and Catherine Krisham, I represent the defendant appellant, Abdul Karim Al-Halabi. Your Honors, the heart of this appeal, what we think it is about at its core, is what we respectfully submit is a vast and unbridgeable gap between the indictment that was returned in this case on the one hand and the law governing the food stamp program and the trial evidence on the other. And that gap has two separate distinct aspects that I would like to discuss today, along with any other issues that this court would like to discuss. And I'm going to describe those two gaps briefly here at the outset and then address them in detail. The first gap is the following. The indictment set forth three wire fraud counts and three food stamp fraud counts under 7 United States Code 2024, what I'll call 2024. The wire fraud counts charged violations of the wire fraud statute by the transmission of food stamp benefits for payment or redemption, and the 2024 counts charged the illegal acquisition, transfer, or possession of food stamp benefits. All of these counts expressly, clearly, and unequivocally identified as the underlying conduct that was supposed to constitute these charged offenses, payments into Holy Land's bank account. That's what the indictment says. The law and the trial evidence were completely different. The law makes very clear, as I'll come to in more detail, that a payment into a retailer's bank account is not a food stamp benefit, nor is it the presentation of a food stamp benefit for payment or redemption. And the trial evidence was exactly the same. There was no effort, even, I submit, by the United States to try to prove that payments into the retailer's bank account, Holy Land's bank account, were food stamp benefits. Instead, as I'll come to, the United States tried a very different case where the food stamp benefits that were the fulcrum of these offenses, or the allegedly fraudulent link transactions, were actual in-store link card swipes, well, not payments into the account.
Well, don't you agree that the clear intent of the statute is to ban precisely the type of fraud that's at issue in this case? And if we read the statute the way you would like us to read it, the result would be legalizing the trading of food stamp benefits for cash?
I agree.
If we go along with your reading of the statute.
The answer to your question, the short answer is no, Judge Williams, and here is why. 2024, I would agree with you that it covers food stamp fraud, but all the government has to do to use that statute to eradicate food stamp fraud is charge actual underlying food stamp swipes. And really what's going on in this case is the following, and that is, and I'll come to this in greater detail, but what happened here, I believe, is that the government found itself on the eve of the statute of limitations running. It knew of no allegedly fraudulent link transactions remaining within the limitations period to charge as offenses, i.e., the transactions the statute is directed at. And so the result is an indictment that charges the transactions the government thought it knew about, payments into the bank account, as if they're food stamp transactions. But to read the statute the way we're reading it, which we submit is the correct reading, in no way shields food stamp frauds. It just says, United States government, you have to indict actual link card fraud. This isn't directed against payments into a retailer's bank account.
Well, if they had, I guess there were three instances, three counts, whatever the days were, two of them would have been chargeable due to the swipe, wouldn't they, if they had done that?
I'm sorry,
as I understand, there's a three-step process, basically. You've got the swipe one day, then it goes into some, clearinghouse or something the second day, and then the deposit the third day, or something like that.
That's right.
Okay, well, they what did they latch on to, the second day or the third day?
What they latched onto was the caboose of that train. What they latched onto was, and incorrectly, I might add, as I'll come to, but what they said is the food stamp benefits at issue here is the electronic transfer of funds into the retailer's account. This is after the transaction in the store. This is after the presentation of that transaction to the clearinghouse for redemption. This is when the bank, although the government got this wrong too, this is when the bank sends the money into the retailer's account. And they said those are food stamps. And that's the presentation of food stamps for payment or redemption. And the law is very clear on this, we submit, that that's absolutely incorrect. So they charge the caboose.
Okay. Well, I guess the question, and maybe for you and the government, is that is this initial swipe, which was when whatever the abuse is, I'm going to call it a swipe since it's an easy thing to identify, can that be the engine and you can't detach the caboose, that it's all one continuing transaction? Does it have to be looked upon that way, or in order for the government to charge this? Is it a follow-up that the swipe initiates, but it doesn't conclude until the deposit?
I think I understand your question, and let me see if I answer it correctly, and you can tell me if I've got it wrong. If the government had been aware, as of October 8, 2003, the day this indictment was returned, and a day on which the government didn't know of any swipes in the store within the remaining limitations period, but let's say they did. Let's say they had an agent who went in undercover and on that day performed allegedly fraudulent swipes. They could have charged those swipes as violations of 2024, which was, I think, what Judge Williams's question was. They could have charged the phone call that the point-of-sale device makes to the clearinghouse as a wire, as the presentation by a transmission over the wires of food stamps for redemption.
On that particular first day.
On that day. Mm-hmm. And I also, arguably what they could have done is they could have said, well, the wire was in furtherance because it transmitted monies into his account from the unlawful swipe. But that, and I want to come directly to that point, this indictment cannot, I submit to you respectfully, be construed or read that way. And the reason is that the language is absolutely clear in the indictment. It says, and we quoted it in our briefs, but I'll just bring it up here and read it again. It's the same in all three counts. It says the following. It says, Abdul Karim Al-Halabi, defendant herein, for the purpose of executing the above-described scheme, knowingly caused to be transmitted for payment and redemption USDA electronic benefit transfer food stamp benefits by wire communication and interstate commerce, certain signs, signals, and sounds, namely an electronic funds transfer. But the wire they're charging, the alleged wire that they claim furthered the scheme, is a presentation of food stamp benefits for payment or redemption. That's the wire they charged. They didn't say, in furtherance of this scheme, you caused money to go into your account. That's not the way they charge this. And I think, although we'll never know, or the government would have to tell us, I think the reason it wasn't charged that way is that they clearly didn't have knowledge of any alleged fraudulent transactions as of that day. But why
doesn't the electronic deposit into your client's bank account constitute the redemption of the food stamp benefits? There's no doubt here that these were food stamp transactions.
Well, it doesn't.
I mean, that's very clear from the trial record. So what we've got is this seeming attempt to parse these transactions into distinct component parts in order to get outside the statute.
Well, I have two answers to that. The first is these are not food stamp transactions. What is alleged in this indictment is the payment back to the retailer that I respect
off of the food stamp link card.
I would say food stamp related, but they are not food stamp transactions. The food stamp transaction is when you go into the store, and I honestly think that's a distinction with a difference. If you look at the regulations, they're very clear. When you present for redemption is when you take it to the bank, and in fact in the days and present it, and you say, I would like these to be redeemed.
So when the retailer collects the money from the government as a result of that transaction and does so fraudulently and in violation of the statute, that doesn't constitute a crime?
It would.
Is that? I mean, that's basically your argument, mm-hmm. that the actual receipt of the money from the government from the fraudulent transaction itself doesn't constitute a crime. That makes no sense to me.
Well, actually, I think my argument is different. That is that the government did not charge the case that you are positing, Judge Sykes. They didn't charge that. This indictment is absolutely clear. They didn't say he furthered the scheme by transmitting monies into his account. And I think the reason for that is because when this indictment was returned, they didn't know of any underlying link transactions that had happened that weren't more than 5 years old. So they had to charge these wire transmissions as if they were the link transactions. And I just want to say something. I know I'm going into rebuttal, but there's another part of my answer to you, and that is that if you look at that language that I just read to you, I submit there's no way around it. And I think the case law tells us why there's no way around it. If you look at United States versus Willis, the court there said, well, look, there was as there was here, there was a motion and arrest of judgment. They said you didn't allege specifically proper mens rea. And the court said, well, we can liberally construe the indictment. It used the word embezzle. And there's no nice meaning to the word embezzle. If I say somebody embezzled, I say they had bad intent. So, you know, you can fairly construe it to say there's mens rea. But if you look at United States versus Leichtman, which is a case that we cite, in Leichtman, there was no dispute, none, that if the government had simply drafted this indictment to say, that the person had had a firearm in connection with a drug crime and had left out the words, to wit, a Mossberg rifle or a Mossberg shotgun, there was no dispute that if the government had just drafted the indictment and ended at firearm, that the United States government could have gotten a conviction that would have been sustainable on appeal. There was no objection below, and this court said that language is not surplusage. We cannot get around it. The government is stuck with it. It's their indictment. And what I'm saying to this court is the following, and that is, if you can't do that in Leichtman, you can't do it here. This is a much worse case for the government than Leichtman, because we don't know that a grand jury would have returned an indictment if the government had said, look, these wires were in furtherance because what he did was he put money into his account. Somebody might have said, well, why is that a crime? And then the question becomes, well, do you have any evidence that there was fraud in the store on the prior day? Go back and look at the grand jury transcript. They talk about April swipes undercover. They talk about some anomalous transactions in 1997. They don't talk about anything in October 1998. So to try the case, they didn't charge the case you're talking about, Judge Sykes. They charged a different case, and they're stuck with that. And to try to present the case you're then talking about is to massively constructively amend. And with that, I'd like to reserve whatever time I have left if the court has no further questions.
Okay. Barton.
May it please the court. My name is Jim Bars, and I represent the United States. All of this is to confuse what's not confusing. This is a simple case. This case is about food stamp fraud on the last 3 days that Holy Land Food had a machine to accept link cards. That's the case we charged. That's the case we proved. You can now do electronically what you used to do through paper. That's not a new or recent change. It's been in effect since March of 1997 in Illinois, and that was in our trial evidence. One of the USDA witnesses testified that ever since March of 1997, stores have been accepting and recipients have been receiving their food stamp benefits on these link cards. That switch from a paper to a paperless society did not convert what was once illegal into something that is now legal. In fact, the statute contemplates that all states are to adopt by 2002 a paperless system and go to these accepting the link cards through or accepting the food stamp benefits through link cards. And that's basically the first argument that he makes, is that because it's done electronically, somehow it has nothing to do with food stamp transactions. That's what people are doing. They're going
in
there.
Certainly, if we were in the ideal world, Congress would update the statute now that we're in an electronic world.
Well, they did, and that's why all this reference to food stamps, that's not the language of 2024. It says coupons. And in 1996, they amended coupons to include cash in lieu of coupons. Okay, and that's what they're getting here. Nobody gets coupons anymore, not the recipients, not the store owners. They can't get handed paper. So when they acquire the coupons, they are acquiring cash in lieu of coupons, and that's exactly what happens when money goes into your bank account.
Well, the issue, at least one of them, is the timing. The swipe, we'll call it day 1, 2, and 3, just for lack of a better way, apparently the time had run on at least one of these, if you did on the day of the swipe, as I understand it. Is that correct?
On October 7th, that was one of the days of the transactions. That would have been time barred.
Yeah, so but by going to the next day or the last day, whichever it is, it gets into that. You get into the time. Is that correct? Am I?
Yes.
Because it would be great if all of these were, because I think those are the cases you cite, essentially were swipe cases, weren't they? Pretty much the precedent?
Yes, or paper cases. There's a lot of paper,
well,
paper cases.
Too. But I mean, I don't think you found a case where someone did charge in the middle of this, or the caboose, as he calls it. This is unique, isn't it?
I don't think there is an identical case cited by either side.
So we have to do what you just said a little earlier and say this is a more confusing issue. Maybe it doesn't matter which step you charge because they're not separable?
Well, I think that's one response. The other response is, in a paper system, it's simple. The food stamp owner, he acquires that coupon when it's handed to him. But in a paperless system, he doesn't acquire anything until that money goes into his account. And that's what happened in that one, we're only talking about one count here, count 4, which is the food stamp count, October 9th. The transactions are on the 7th. The money comes in on October 9th, and that's when he's acquiring the coupons, or the cash in lieu of coupons, as we call it. That's when he acquired the cash. He acquired it on October 9th. He didn't acquire it on October 7th, and that's why we think it's proper, and that's why it was charged that way.
It doesn't relate back to the original swipe, then, which would take at least one of them out of the statute limitation.
The swipes occurred on October 7th.
Yeah. The 7th swipe is out of time if you just charge on the 7th, right? Isn't
yes.
That, yeah. So it has to go all the way to the 9th. And the transaction on the 9th or the 8th doesn't relate back to the 7th.
He gets
based on time. And yet it seems that it has to relate back somehow or other, or at least they all have to be tied together as one continuing transaction.
It is one transaction that's not completed until the 9th. It's, you could imagine a number of crimes that take several steps days to complete. It starts, it's like if you send the demand letter on October 7th and the guy delivers the money on October 9th, haven't you still committed the extortion by receiving the money on the 9th?
Yeah, I guess they say you should have charged in furtherance of the scheme or something on that order.
Well, we did, and that's the wire fraud counts, and that's why all this whole distinction mm-hmm. between food stamp coupons, that doesn't apply to wire fraud. I mean, wire fraud, the elements there are scheme to defraud and a wire. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that this wire, the money comes in on the 9th. So that's not an issue for those three counts, and that's why that argument can't apply to the wire fraud counts. It only applies, if anything, to count 4, where you've got transactions on the 7th, the money coming in on the 9th, but we still think it's completed on the 9th. That's when he acquires the cash in lieu of the coupons, just from a plain reading of the statute.
And does it require knowing that that's the whole process? You have to know that process is going to take place in order for it to be the crime?
Well, yes, and he knows it's the process because he was signed up for the training, and in the training, they explain to him the process, and when they give him the machine, he identifies his bank account. And so he's been receiving for many months into his bank account.
So he knows a swipe on the 7th means a deposit on the 9th.
He knows that because...
And it won't be completed until that of the 9th.
He knows that because he's been in the program since March of 1997 when they went to an electronic system. And our scheme began in July of 1997, which is what we charged. The second issue raised is that, well, this is multiple wires. Government's response, and this goes to the wire fraud counts, is that it's not. It's a single wire. Starts in Chicago and it ends in Austin. Now, Illinois and Texas don't touch, so obviously it's going to pass through some states along the way. That doesn't mean that it's somehow multiple wires. It's a computer process that starts when it leaves Chicago and it ends, or when it leaves Austin, and it ends when it arrives with the deposit into his account in Chicago. It's only one wire that goes out every day. The testimony on that was exactly that.
Is it a three-day wire?
It's a wire that takes 2 days, and then remember we have the intervening Columbus Day and holiday weekend.
Oh, but well, okay. Let's.
You got banking hours. The money's not going to go into the account. It's only going to go in during banking hours. So it goes out for the 7th. So the transaction's on the 7th. The wire leaves on the 8th, and it goes in, I believe, on the 10th. And the one on the 9th, because the weekend doesn't get there till the 13th.
Yeah.
But it's a single process, and it's a single wire. Now, to the extent that this court would interpret that as multiple wires, we would argue that there is no material variance. Each wire, as he's tried to divide them up, is an interstate wire. Each was proven to the jury. And I would posit this as sort of the hypothetical response. What should we have done? Should we have charged him with one crime in Austin, one crime in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and another crime in Chicago? Would there be any doubt that he would be sitting here today arguing that that was multiplicity, that we had charged him with three crimes for what was one event, which was the redemption of these food stamps in exchange for discounted amounts of cash?
Well, it's clear if we were to charge on the swipe day, there'd be, we wouldn't be here, or whatever. It'd be easier.
We don't have, well, I guess the response to that is, I don't think that the statute limits or confines okay. to the day of the swipe.
It's just that that's what everybody's done before today.
In some cases.
Well, maybe there is a case that where
I don't know if it's ever been charged this way in other right. cases. There's no reported decisions where this issue's been raised challenging it. But I would defend it as there's absolutely nothing wrong with charging it. And, you know, defense counsel's comment, well, the government didn't know about any particular bad transactions on those days. I dispute that. I wasn't the AUSA that charged this case, but we tried it. We had a circumstantial evidence case that basically said from July of 1997 through the last 3 days in business, this guy was doing it every day. And we had that based upon the high level of redemptions, the trafficking patterns, and I've got the government exhibits here that show multiple transactions, $90, back-to-back in a matter of seconds, in a store that has no optical scanners, one checkout lane. It cannot be done. When's the last time you were in, as I said to the jury when all these same arguments were raised, when's the last time you were in a 7-Eleven? The guy in front of you had $120 in groceries, went through in 30 seconds. Okay? So we had a circumstantial evidence case. We made our case better at trial. We're allowed to do that. We called in some witnesses who actually said, yeah, I was there. We went to the people that were there on those days, right? We looked at their records, 7th, 8th, and 9th, sent out the agent. She got a few of these witnesses. They came in. They said, yes, every day I was there, and I bought anything. The most I bought was $3 or $4 worth of food. Everything else was cash, trading cash, getting discounted amounts of cash for my benefits. And then we put in their records showing that they were there on the 7th, 8th, or 9th.
When this system was based on the paper coupons, would your office typically charge the date of the fraudulent underlying transaction in the store or the date that the retailer redeemed the coupons with the government?
Well, we would charge either, and I think you could charge either. And I think there's examples of that in some of the cases I cited, and I can't pull out which one now, but I think there. One of the cases we cited in my brief was an example where they charged specific bad transactions, but they also charged the aggregate redemptions for the year. And, you know, that would be sort of a circumstantial evidence case. If a guy estimates he's going to do $100,000 in business and he redeems $2 million in coupons, even if you can't identify one single bad transaction, you have a circumstantial evidence case that some of those transactions were link fraud. You combine that circumstantial evidence with what I showed, was you've got to sort of zero in on the actual daily transactions and say, okay, look at this now. This guy's done $100 back to back to back in a store with no optical scanners, one checkout lane. How can that be done if that's actual food sales? Plus, you go in, you surveil the store. They don't have that kind of food. They're selling potato chips and pops, things like that. Plus, combined in this case, he said, oh, well, I was selling meat. And the evidence was that there was a broken meat counter that was never fixed. So even if we didn't have those witnesses at the end, absolutely we would charge this case the exact same way, and we would go to trial on a circumstantial evidence case. By the time of trial, we made it better. We combined our circumstantial evidence with direct evidence. The employee who said yes defendant taught me how to do this. I've seen him do it. And then our witnesses who said, yeah, I went in there and did it.
We're with all this history, why was this case charged so late?
I can't speak to that. I didn't charge it. But I can say that it wasn't charged late. It was charged timely. And
there was a crime committed
on those last 3 days.
It's a much bigger case than what it was.
The scheme went
on the caboose, as they say.
The scheme went from July of 97 through the last 3 days in business. We could have charged additional days. However, by the time we charged it, we had 3 days left, and those were the last 3 days in business. Wires and bank deposits all followed after that were timely. So, for all those reasons, the government respectfully requests that, and I would point out that all of these arguments were raised to the district court. Judge Cannelli issued a written memorandum denying these arguments. They were also presented to the jury as factual arguments, and we just ask that this court affirm the convictions and overrule these objections, which were overruled by both the jury and the district court in this case.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Connor, you've got 2 minutes.
2 minutes. I'd like to begin with a question Mr. Barrs asked and end with an observation that you made, Judge Mannion. Mr. Barrs asked, what should the government have done? And my answer to that is, if the government wanted to try a case where the transfers into the retailer's account were in furtherance of the scheme because they put money into the account on the basis of fraudulent transactions the day before, the government should have charged its case earlier and then written an indictment that said that. What the government can't do is return an indictment that says what this indictment says and then walk away from it and try a completely different case. Leichtman tells us that. Numerous cases tell us that. The United States government didn't say here at oral argument, they do claim in their brief, that payments into a retailer's account are food stamp benefits. They clearly are not. A few brief points. This case is not about the change from paper to electronic benefits. That's the statute was updated to take that into account. We've shown in our brief it clearly doesn't cover payments into a retailer's account. What is redemption? Judge Sykes, the regulations are absolutely clear. Redemption is when you present to the bank. It's not the money coming out of the bank. And it says, presented for payment or redemption. That's their indictment. And they have to live with that language. That's how they got it. That's how they got a timely indictment. And the bargain there is, you have to prove that case. You can't say, I'm going to forestall the statute of limitations by charging these things in the way that they did, and then try a completely different case.
The electronic payment has got to be part of the redemption process. Otherwise, what's the point? I mean, redemption doesn't end at the time that the presentation of the request for money is made.
No,
the presenter expects the money to be paid, right? That's all part of the redemption process. You can't separate that out.
Well, I would dispute
reading.
That based on the regulations, number one, but I would say this. That's not what the indictment charges. Knowingly caused to be transmitted for payment or redemption.
Right.
That's their charge. That's what they have to prove.
And that's what happened here. He presented for payment or redemption, and the redemption was made, and the money was deposited.
Well, I respectfully disagree.
I mean,
if
we read the regulations so narrowly, then the government doesn't ever have to pay on any of these claims from retailers, right? If redemption stops at the time that the presentation is made.
No, I think what's missing in this is the actual language of the indictment. If we were talking about a civil suit, I think I probably would take your part in this. But this is a different matter. They indicted the front. They charged the front end of that transaction and then hitched up to it the back end. They're very different. I would just leave the court with this thought. It was Judge Mannion's observation, and that is, has this been done before today? And the answer is no. And it's not just no with respect to the wire fraud counts and the question whether these payments are food stamps or the presentation for payment or redemption, but it's also true on these underlying wires. What the government should have done is charged one or the other of the two wires that happened. It was not a clerical error that they corrected. It was a failure to understand and present the facts.
Okay. Thank you very much. I understand you were court-appointed. Is that right?
Yes, we all were.
Well, I appreciate your accepting the assignment and your advocacy for your client.
Thank you, Judge.
Case be taken under advisement. We'll move to the next case.